Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Tuesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. In part one of today's program, a look back at the Revolutionary War and at a group of soldiers who made a huge difference. We'll talk with the author of a book called Washington's Immortals. In part two of the program today, we're going to be talking about those now iconic black and yellow books that you see in bookstores, the Four Dummies series. How did that get started, and just how big a phenomenon has that become? We'll explore that in part two of today's morning show here on WGTD. I have had the great pleasure on several previous occasions to speak with best-selling author Patrick K. O'Donnell, a military historian who has written a number of really, really interesting books, including Beyond Valor, Dog Company, and First Seals. He has served in a number of different capacities in and around military exploits, has provided historical consulting for DreamWorks miniseries called Band of Brothers, and worked on a number of highly regarded documentaries. His books, by and large, have focused on more recent conflicts, but his most recent book turns all the way back to the American Revolution, and it's a fascinating book indeed called Washington's Immortals, the untold story of an elite regiment who changed the course of the Revolution. We're talking about a group of men from in and around Baltimore, Maryland, who were very, very crucial to the Americans ultimately emerging victorious from the American Revolution, which was by no means a foregone conclusion. And it's a largely untold story, which is explored in remarkable detail in this book published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Again, the book is called Washington's Immortals. And Patrick K. O'Donnell, we welcome you back to the morning show.
It's great to be back on with you, Greg.
As I'm glancing at the list of previous books, and I know the books that we've talked about were all in and around conflicts in the 20th and maybe even early 21st century. I know we have never talked about anything involving a conflict as old as the American Revolution. How different did this feel for you to be turning your attention to this kind of conflict and to do research for what is a relatively distant in the past conflict?
Greg, this is a very challenging book to write. In fact, many experts and weighed in and said it was impossible to write because the sources simply didn't exist for the book. But it took me 6 years of meticulous research, combing the world, including the United Kingdom, to unearth, you know, a story that had been lost and forgotten. And Washington's Immortals is that story. I'm not sure sometimes how I was able to put it together, but there's over 1,000 sources in this nearly 500-page book that is the first cinematic treatment of the American Revolution. It's the first Band of Brothers-type treatment of the Revolution. Instead of telling the story of just the regiment, it's actually the men, the key officers and enlisted men that did most of the fighting. And it's their entire story beginning in 1774, in a tavern in Baltimore City, where men of honor, family, and fortune coalesced because they had seen what was going on in Boston, for instance, where the British had blockaded the harbor and thrown thousands of Americans out of work, and they wanted to do something. They wanted to make a difference, and they formed the first independent company called the Baltimore Independent Cadets, And these were some of the richest men in Baltimore. They came together and they outfitted themselves with the best weapons and uniforms that money could buy, and they started to train. And this began, this small core group formed the nucleus and cadre for some of the greatest fighting regiments of the American Revolution. And they were involved in the key inflection points and the key battles, the most crucial battles of the American Revolution. And what was interesting about the research is it's in their own words. I use something called pension files or pension affidavits as a primary source throughout the book. And these are the hidden, this is the hidden war of the American Revolution. These are the hidden sources. And what I meant by that is in like the 1820s and 30s, if you were lucky enough to survive the American Revolution, and not a lot of people did, I mean, they would have had to live to a fairly long old age. They could go down to, a veteran of the American Revolution could go down to the local courthouse and swear under oath what they did. And this is the hidden war of the American Revolution that is hardly, it's not even in most books. It's what these enlisted men, these privates and sergeants, and even the and a lot of the officers that did fighting recalled. And it's in their own words that this book really kind of captures the hidden side of the American Revolution, which is a very long and bloody war. It was 8 years. And it was against the greatest army of the world at the time, or one of the most adaptable armies, at least. And common people like Mordecai Gist, who was a sea captain and a merchant who founded the Baltimore Independent Cadets, came together. But as the story goes on, this is a book about average Americans, too, about farmers and artisans, as well as about 7 to 9% of the Maryland line were free African Americans. This is an integrated unit, integrated by class and race. And I think that's one of the things that really makes this a very personal and interesting look at the American Revolution.
Absolutely. When we think about some of those fairly wealthy men who really formed the initial nucleus of this group, you make a couple of important points about them, including this one. You say many of the company's members were prosperous merchants. For them, the decision to join the company meant sacrificing their livelihood. And that's the kind of sacrifice that could so easily go completely unacknowledged by us, I mean, after all of this time. But, I mean, what a momentous choice for these men to make.
Greg, you bring up a great point. I mean, these guys literally sacrificed not only their livelihood, their jobs, their careers, their small business or their large business. Gist, for instance, is almost kind of a Bill Gates-sized figure that had an enormous fortune. He puts it all on the line for the cause. And many of these officers, they paid for their own equipment, they paid for their men's equipment, and they paid for their men's food, because many of these guys never, they were never paid, even through the whole war. And this sets up for a very interesting dynamic. Many of the men in this book actually go into bankruptcy after the war. And in colonial or in the early United States, there was still debtor's prison. And some of the main characters of this book actually, they survived, you know, the greatest battles of the American Revolution. They sacrifice their fortunes for the cause, and then they're thrown in prison. Hmm. And as debtors, it's striking. It's amazing. And it's, you know, it's that sacrifice and the sacrifice of many, many unknown, unsung heroes, such as Thomas Kearny, for instance, who's a free African-American that comes on around the Battle of Brandywine in 1777. This is when the British are making an amphibious. They're landing in Maryland at Elk's Head, and they're trying to drive towards our early capital in Philadelphia. And Kearny is there at Brandywine at this epic battle and fights through the entire war. And it's, you know, I found a reference to him in his pension application of bayoneting 7 British soldiers at the Battle of Guilford Courthouse, where the Marylanders play an important role. in changing the course of the American Revolution, Cornwallis actually leaves the Carolinas and goes to Yorktown. It's like small sacrifices like that. And then it sets up for a very interesting dynamic. This book is about brotherhood and friendship. And many of these men were tied together by strong bonds of friendship, brotherhood, and family. They were interrelated. And the friendship that I'm talking about with Kearney is quite interesting because in a place called 96, in a fort, it's not far from the Augusta, Georgia, but it's in South Carolina, the loyal Americans as well as the British had a series of forts there. And it's one of the great untold stories of the war. We had to lay siege to the fort. And the fort at 96 was a star-shaped fort made of earth. And it was an epic siege that lasted nearly a month, and we were assaulting the fort. They even tunneled underneath the fort to try to blow it up with explosives. And the tunnel, interestingly enough, still exists to this day. But Kearney was involved in what's known as the Forlorn Assault. And this is a desperate assault on the fort at the closing days of the siege, because the British were bringing in reinforcements. And General Greene, the Washington's Immortal covers his Southern Army. The Marylanders were the key component of that, along with Thomas Kearney, who was in it. They assault the Star Fort on the Forlorn Hope, and Kearney's in it, and it's quite interesting. The men are pinned down in an epic firefight, and Kearney's captain is shot through the head. And Kearney, who's a strapping, muscular African-American, picks him up and rescues him from the line of fire. And it sets up a friendship that lasts 30 or 40 years. And Kearney and Captain Perry Benson, who's later General Benson in the War of 1812, Kearney and Benson meet Lafayette after the war, when Lafayette returns to America, long after the American Revolution.
One of the other aspects of the formation of this group is also something that could so easily go unacknowledged. And again, we're talking about sort of the cost of this before they're even engaged in battle. You write, voluntary enlistment in these independent companies violated British imperial law. Doing so represented open defiance of crown rule and constituted an act of treason potentially punishable by death. Again, this is before someone has done so much as held a gun in their hands, let alone, you know, shot at someone British. I mean, just the act of forming a group like this and of being part of it. This was a courageous step that these men were taking.
It was a courageous step that was punishable by death. And we're dealing with the British Empire, who prior to that had never lost an insurrection, had always stamped out every revolution. And for instance, around the same time there was a revolution or a rebellion in Ireland, and the Crown crushed it. And anyone that basically was an insurgent or went against the Crown was subject to a horrific death. And I found an account where the men were, anyone that was caught, they were, a judge ordered them to be hanged at the neck and then to be brought out before they were killed. And then their stomach was opened up in front of them and their bowels were taken out as the person was alive, and it was burned in front of them, and then they were decapitated and drawn and quartered. I mean, this is horrific stuff. And I mean, the penalty for going against the grain, going against the crown, you know, these men were considered treasonous. And I think that's where there's an incredible amount of courage to do that, but also to sacrifice their livelihoods. And these men really believed in freedom and liberty. They also didn't like to be told what to do. They weren't into, as merchants, they did not like the bureaucracy in London dictating their every move, dictating how that they could, who they could trade with and who they couldn't trade with, etc. And they basically, in the name of liberty, fought for this country to create it.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Patrick K. O'Donnell. His new book is called Washington's Immortals, The Untold Story of an Elite Regiment Who Changed the Course of the Revolution. It's a really, really amazingly thorough look at what the Smallwood Battalion, this group of men from Maryland, managed to accomplish through the course of this long and hard-fought war. You mentioned a number of interesting things along the way. One of them was that, in some respects, the Revolutionary War was also a civil war. And you spend a fair amount of time in your book talking about the division between patriots and loyalists, those who were loyal to the British crown. You say this was a division that tore many colonies and many families apart. Just say a word about why you felt that this particular theme warranted this kind of attention in your book. I mean, just how significant was this?
It was incredibly significant because we were fighting not only the greatest, one of the greatest armies in the world, most adaptable armies in the world, British Army, as well as their Hessian or German mercenaries. We were fighting fellow Americans, which were even, you know, just as tough in some cases. And that's what made, I think it's the school book version of the American Revolution that many of us were taught. This is a very nuanced and gritty view of the American Revolution that most people don't realize, that this country was divided. But, you know, there's never been real clear numbers on how many Americans were loyal to the crown, but there were about 80,000 after the war had actually left the United States. So many, many more, maybe up to a third Americans were actually sided with the crown. And this is a theme that runs through Washington's Immortals in many ways. Many of the families themselves of these patriots were divided. For instance, John Gunby, who's a colonel in the Maryland line, and he fights through the war, but he has to deal very early on with his father, who is an ardent loyalist. And many of the men from geographically Maryland was divided between by the eastern shore of Maryland and then also the main portion of Maryland, which is also on the East Coast. But the eastern shore was largely loyalist, and Gunby came from the eastern shore, and his father was an ardent loyalist. But Gunby made a decision to basically become a patriot, and he said, you know, one of my favorite lines in the book is, "I'd rather sink in a patriot's grave than wear the crown of England." He was an ardent, he destroyed his family, but he believed in the cause. These men believed against all odds what they were doing. But as the war goes on, it's a long, eight long years, Greg, of war. Washington's Immortals captures the suffering, I mean, hyperinflation, the defeats, which were many. And these men, they wavered. Some of them wavered. And I captured the men that changed sides, too. Sometimes it was because they were forced to potentially go on a British concentration camp ship, or a hell ship, if you will, in New York Harbor, where many of them, up to 18,000 Americans, starved to death on these floating hell ships. Or they were given the choice of fighting in the British Army. And many of them did that, and then some of them jumped back and forth. And I sort of capture that side of the American Revolution, which is kind of a hidden war also.
Absolutely. It's interesting, too. We've been mostly talking about these men, these courageous men, and so on. But one of the most interesting moments in the book comes in Chapter 7, titled Maryland Goes to War, in which you spell out yet another largely untold story within the American Revolution. You write, at one point, Smallwood's battalion included not only men, wives, mothers, daughters, mistresses, and other assorted women marched along with the men, looking for safety and work. These camp followers, as they later became known, had a complicated relationship with the military hierarchy. Tell our listeners more about that complicated relationship and what kind of role these women played in what we're talking about.
Camp followers are kind of another one of these hidden aspects of the American Revolution. And Washington's Immortals captures sort of many common women that followed the army. And the complicated relationship stems from the fact that many of them drew rations like regular soldiers. And these men were starving. But these women provided many valuable services. Sometimes they were nurses. They actually sewed together uniforms. They washed. They prepared food. They even spied in rare occasions on the British. But the book also captures the great loves that many of these men had. And many of the Marylanders had. There's epic love stories in this book. And one of those camp followers was Jenny Ramsey. And she followed her husband through the whole war. They had a covered wagon, and they had a large, you know, with their many of their household goods, etc. And she followed the army. And Mrs. Ramsey, when they camped, the social life of the army was around her campsite for the officers of the Maryland line, and they would talk about, you know, exploits, etc. And I thought that Mrs. Ramsey's dedication and love is an epic one, because Nathaniel Ramsey, who's this 33-year-old lawyer from Cecil County, Maryland, is a regimental commander as the war goes on. He survives the Battle of Brooklyn miraculously, and he's asked during the Battle of Monmouth by Washington to personally charge his regiment into the vortex and halt a British overwhelming assault on the American line. The line was collapsing, and Ramsey's regiment was basically there to hold things together while Washington brought the army up. And he does that, and it's an amazing story of how he actually, it's a microcosm of the battle, he actually encounters his counterpart, and he's unhorsed. And as he's unhorsed, he's about to be slashed to death by the British officer's saber, and he reveals his Masonic, according to legend, his Masonic ring. Many of the men on the Maryland line were some of the most powerful Freemasons in America. And interestingly enough, many British officers were too. It crossed the Atlantic. And the Masonic ring allowed him to have quarter. But getting back to Mrs. Ramsey, her dedication is so amazing that she actually goes into captivity with her husband in New York City. And, you know, the Ramseys were so wealthy that they were able to buy a mansion in New York City, and he was paroled. He was able to walk around New York City but not leave, unlike most of the enlisted men who were thrown into these hell ships and many starved to death. Hmm. So it's an interesting aspect of the American Revolution that most people have never heard about.
Absolutely. Help us understand just how, in a sense, cohesive a unit this was, because I think a lot of us who aren't as well read in such matters just think of the American Army as just this mass of soldiers, and at different points different groups got sent off to different places, but we don't often think of it as being comprised of individual groups that somehow coalesced into a mass fighting force. I mean, exactly what was the relationship between this group of men from Baltimore and the rest of the army?
The army was made up of many different groups. For instance, mariners from Marblehead, Massachusetts, to over mountain men, men that lived in western Tennessee that were living in the wilds of the frontier, that had to fight off Native American Indian attacks. They had to fight the weather. They lived there illegally. Or to Philadelphia Associators, men that were one of Benjamin Franklin's early militias in Philadelphia that elected their own officers, to men of the Maryland line, who this core group are wealthy merchants that sign, they sign basically a contract that they will fight together, that there will not be any, they'll act as gentlemen. There won't be any kind of corporal punishment, but they'll follow the rules of warfare. And this is the core group, though, that are it's quite interesting, Greg. Many of the men, the Washington's Immortals, are bound together by deep friendships like Thomas Kearney and Captain Perry Benson to actual ties, family ties. Like Ramsey was married to the Peel, the Charles Wilson Peel fame. James Peel, for instance, was an ensign, a flag bearer. But many of the families were all connected. These men were all connected by family, and so they were willing to sacrifice their lives for not only deep bonds of friendship, but also family.
Mm. The last question regards another theme that we follow in your book, and that is the matter of adaption. That one of the really important matters when it came to who was going to ultimately be victorious in this conflict was which army, the British or the American, was going to more successfully adapt to sort of the new realities that were part of this particular conflict and where it was being fought. And of course, ultimately, the Americans proved to be incredibly resourceful and adaptable. And these men from Baltimore certainly seem to be the epitome of that. Just to talk for a moment about how significant this was and how the war ultimately played out.
The American Revolution, in many ways, is about American way of war. That was on how we wage it, and that is everything from proper use of intelligence to economy of force. We're not throwing men's lives away on needless battles. Use of overwhelming firepower. There's a lot of, use of terrain, for instance, to, hide behind trees or stone walls, collapsible defenses. The American army was highly adaptable during the American Revolution, and we fought not only we sort of fought a hybrid type of war. Many times it was conventional, sometimes using the same tactics that the British had in terms of European battle style tactics, but it was also our own. And both armies, the British army typically gets dinged as this guy that sort of line up on a field. The British army was highly adaptable as well. And this involves everything from their cavalry to their light infantry tactics, which were kind of an early precursor in some ways to special operations or light infantry troops. And the Marylanders were also part of this cutting edge revolution of warfare. The Marylanders were light infantry in various stages of the American Revolution, and they pioneered. They were our first elite unit. They were Washington's finest troops that were shock troops in many ways. They were sent into inflection points of the battle, like Nathaniel Ramsey. His regiment is put in the line to stem this massive tide of British soldiers at the Battle of Monmouth. It happens multiple times during the Revolution. And these Marylanders, though, are constantly adapting and changing. And the light infantry story is fascinating. A vignette that I probably would like to bring up would be at the Battle of the Bronx. And this is an unknown story for the most part. And I'll never forget, I'm doing the research, and I found that over a dozen Braves were killed. And I'll never forget, I found this in a letter. And I'm like, Braves, what are they talking about? But there were actually Native Americans that fought alongside the Marylanders.
Wow.
As light infantry. And it's an amazing, it's an epic story, Greg, of how the king, the tribal, the chief of the Stockbridge Indians, who fought alongside of us. Most Native Americans fought for the British, but the Stockbridge Indians fought for the United States. And the chief and his son sacrificed their lives against a guy by the name of Simcoe, who had a ranger unit, also in a light infantry unit, against the Marylanders. So it was an epic fight between two elite units. And the chief sacrifices his life. He charges into the battle line and assaults Simcoe on horseback and is killed. But he allows many of the Marylanders to escape, like Jack Stewart, who's the main character of the book. It's a small piece of history that's been forgotten, but it's the Stockbridge Indians. You know, sadly enough, the tribe only received, after these grievous losses they suffered at the Bronx, they only received a piddly $1,000 for their great service to the United States.
Hmm. Your book is full of fascinating and largely unknown stories about this really crucial conflict, and it really underscores how we tend to think of this conflict in such simplistic terms. And I really am grateful for you writing a book that really helps us see this conflict with much more nuance and with a rich field of detail. The book again is called Washington's Immortals, The Untold Story of an Elite Regiment Who Changed the Course of the Revolution, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. It includes a number of very, very interesting illustrations and photographs. The author, Patrick K. O'Donnell. Patrick O'Donnell, what a great pleasure to speak with you again. Congratulations on yet another fine book.
Thanks, Greg. It's always a pleasure to be on your show.
The time is 8:41. You're listening to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD HD, your gateway to public radio. Part two is coming up in a moment. Walk into any bookstore and especially go to the reference section, and you are almost certain to run into a host of books which are the Four Dummies series. They cover a plethora of different topics. The first Four Dummies books were all technology inclined. The very first book was DOS for Dummies. But by now, there are books like Chess for Dummies and Figure Skating for Dummies and Opera for Dummies, books covering just about every topic you can imagine. And over the intervening years, over 2,700 different titles have been produced. Not only books, but also instructional videos, and even some games bearing the logo of the Four Dummies series. And some of the books have actually been published in other languages. Many millions of copies now have been sold of the Four Dummies series, which feature that iconic cover with the black and yellow coloring and the sort of blackboard bearing the title. And you also almost always see the comic illustrations of artist Rich Tennant. On today's morning show, this portion of the program, you're going to be hearing my conversation with Mark Mikulich, Vice President for Brand Management at Wiley Publishing, which is responsible now for publishing the Four Dummies series. You were mentioning before we went on the air that the first of these Four Dummies books actually appeared way back in 1991. It's a book which I imagine nowadays is no longer a bestseller. Tell us a little bit about that first entry in this series.
Sure. That first book was called DOS for Dummies, for the old disk operating system that was what people used prior to Microsoft introducing the Windows user interface. And in 1991, it was, people can think back to that. It was a time in American social history, I guess, when corporations were pretty much throwing out their IBM self-correcting Selectric 3 typewriters and putting PCs on their employees' desks. And what had previously been something you could disregard as a kind of technophile's tinker toy suddenly was the essential business productivity tool. You had to word process. You had to use spreadsheets. You had to do things called desktop publishing and whatnot. And a lot of people were suddenly feeling pretty dumb about all of this. Well, sales rep had gone into a bookstore and overheard a customer talking to a clerk, complaining about the findings in the computer book section, saying, "I can't make heads or tails of this stuff. Haven't you got something like a DOS for dummies?" And from that observation was developed a plan to publish a book.
And to call it DOS for Dummies.
Yeah.
And, of course, aside from the just the matter of alliteration and the fact that there's something pretty catchy about that title, it's also a title which is so helpful because it displays for all the world to see exactly what the mission of that book was.
You would think that. You'd say, well, its purpose is so clear that this is going to be a no-brainer. Uh-huh. But in fact, when the book was published, it broke all the rules, and there was a lot of resistance to getting it on the bookshelves. First of all, the operating system at that point, which was DOS 5, Microsoft was up to version 5 of DOS, had already been on the marketplace for some 5 or 6 months and had been heavily published. And the rules of the game were you publish computer books day and date with the release of new software. You don't wait 6 months to publish a book. So, you know, booksellers said, why do we need another DOS book? And especially, why do we need one with this garish yellow and black cover and cartoons on the cover and inside and what, you've got jokes in here and you can't call people dummies and so on and so on. Large bookstore chains were refusing to take the book and so on and so forth. And there was even some movement within the publishing group to just kill the book. But the publisher prevailed, said, I know this is something consumers want. And so we printed 7,500 copies to start, which in book publishing is nothing. And those 7,500 copies were gone in a week. And another 75 printed, and they were gone in a week. And 15,000 were gone in 2 weeks. And then I think an order came in for 50,000 units, and, you know, we all knew we were still going to have a job next week.
Very good.
That's
so, maybe the folks in the bookstore weren't catching on, but the customers shopping in the bookstore, I mean, as far as they were concerned, it was a perfect title and a perfect concept.
It taught us a very powerful lesson about staying close to your real consumers and not letting, you know, your intermediaries dictate, you know, what you should or shouldn't be thinking about what consumers need. And we've continued to try and reach out to consumers directly ever since then through things like dummies.com, where people can sign up for free e-tips on any number of subjects and so forth, and various promotions we run in stores right now. There's a thing called Dummies Month that's going on. It's now early April, we're talking, and this has been going on for some weeks. There's all sorts of things that revolve around that, contests at our websites and so forth.
Over the years, I mean, hundreds of different volumes have appeared in this series on every topic under the sun. How have those topics been chosen over the years? I mean, is it just a bunch of people sitting around a table brainstorming, or has there been sort of a more ordered process at work here?
Well, it kind of gets back to what we were just talking about and listening to consumers. You know, once we published the first book, there were obvious next ones to do, which from the perspective of history seems funny. It was very important we did WordPerfect for Dummies because that was the dominant word processing program at that time. Now, of course, it's Word. And we did PCs for Dummies and so forth, Macs for Dummies. And people would write to us these wonderful, touching letters. Oh, my God, I couldn't figure out how to use a computer right until, you know, you've helped me with my learning, whatever, and now I can talk to my grandson and blah, blah, blah. And they'd say, well, okay, you taught me how to use Excel. You taught me how to use Quicken. Now will you help me manage my personal finances? In other words, take it from a pure software application to its actual real-life application. And then in 1994, having published up until then nothing but computer books, from consumer feedback, we said, okay, we're going to publish Personal Finance for Dummies. Was not a well-known author, was not, you know, part of our publishing brief to date, but it went on to be a million-plus seller. And then we said, okay, you know, we have to expand our vision. And then around the same time, the Internet and the World Wide Web emerged, and once again, the role of computers in people's lives was changing. And now the computer became the kind of microwave oven of information that, you know, people could go to for every area of human interest and endeavor. And, well, if we taught people how to use their PCs, how to use their operating systems and applications, how to use the Internet and the web, shouldn't we be there for all the other topics they're going to explore? And that became, you know, a platform for publishing into all these other areas.
Hmm. Now, of course, it takes a lot more than just a snappy title on the cover to make this, in fact, a viable vehicle for someone who is a dummy, in quotation marks, to learn what they need to know about something. So let's talk a bit about how the inside of the book has been handled over the years to make these helpful books for people who begin with bewilderment and very little background in whatever it is they need to know about. What kinds of editorial decisions have been made to make these books as helpful as they have turned out to be?
Well, the genius of Dummies, if we can say that, is that we have a system for organizing information that works for just about any topic. And once you've used one Dummies book, you know how to use anyone. And that, I think, is what enables people to return to Dummies as a knowledge tool and resource again and again and again. The first chapter always tells you what you're going to find throughout the rest of the book and where. The book contains not just a table of contents, but a contents at a glance, so you can quickly identify what's there. And the use of icons and sidebars throughout the book key people into understanding that certain bits of information are for certain uses and may be disregarded if it's not what you're into the book for. And in this way, we create something that does not have to be read from first page to last linearly. You can dip in and out of it in whatever manner serves your needs best. And that, I think, is really the key to what makes it such an extendable success across all categories.
Right. Well, and of course, it's no small matter for an expert to sit down and write something which clearly explains something to those that don't know nearly so much about it. I mean, in some respects, an expert is the last person you want to try to explain something, because so often they just don't remember what it's like to not be a whiz at computers or opera or whatever the topic might be. How has this series managed so well to keep the writing on such a simple, accessible level? I mean,
that's a really great point, because obviously some experts are so academic in their understanding of a topic. You know, if you're going to read a book on nanotechnology for dummies, for example, you know, it can't be as esoteric as the subject inherently is. It's got to be brought down or communicated at a level that's conversational. And it is an ongoing effort to find authors who have the requisite expertise in the subject matter and the communication skill. And when we find such an author and we determine that they can write to the Dummies template for organizing information, then a partnership between an author and a project editor is formed. Hmm. And that's how these books get developed. And there's a team of folks who've been working on these books now for some time who have the format down as far as the editorial component goes. And we just are constantly looking for authors who fit our topic needs and our communication needs.
Hmm. It really has been an amazing success story. I mean, millions and millions of books published, and how many different volumes are we talking about now?
There are somewhere around 1,000 different titles currently in print, and listeners can see a full list of those at dummies.com, and they'll see all the ones that are new, flagged with a bright red new symbol. In terms of actual units, there are over 150 million units in print in the U.S. There have been translations in over 30 languages, and these books have been distributed in over 100 countries around the world.
Hmm. Well, and in somewhat the ultimate compliment, there are one or two knockoffs out there. I mean, other how-to books that clearly are interested in trying to secure a similar sort of piece of the pie. In your estimation, what sets the For Dummies series aside from some of its imitators?
Well, the fact that there is a lot more to Dummies books than simply a cute, quasi-confrontational title. You know, there is a very rigorous editorial discipline to the books. There's a consistency of tone through that management of the whole editorial process. And, you know, a unity of purpose. We're all about enriching people's lives by making knowledge accessible. That's what we do. We do it better than anybody. You know, people can ape a certain stance or what they perceive as a marketing positioning, but, you know, what's going to be between the pages and consistently between the pages across 900, 1,000 different books on as many topics, that's what differentiates us. There's nobody out there with the publishing program that we've got in this space.
A last question. Do you ever think very much about that presumably nameless customer standing in line who was asking, don't you have something like DOS for Dummies? I mean, whoever that guy is out there someplace, doesn't he deserve a slice of the glory here?
I just hope that customer is shopping for a lot more than just books these days, because we've got Dummies DVDs, we've got Dummies culinary kits, we've got Dummies automotive products, we've got Dummies card games, we've got Dummies grilling sets. And all of this, again, if people go to dummies.com and visit the specialty shop, they'll see the whole range of products that's out there. Dummies is a lot more than just books. It's a way of approaching every area of human interest and endeavor, and I hope that customer is still there with us.
Very good, and hopefully he's figured out DOS by now. Whatever that is. Mark Mikulich with Wiley Publication, and Wiley is responsible for publishing the series For Dummies. Mark Mikulich, this has been fun. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it's the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. On Thursday's program, I look forward to welcoming back to the program a faculty colleague from Carthage, Jerry Mast from the Political Science Department. We'll be looking back on the results of today's election here in Wisconsin, who ended up coming out on top in the presidential primaries. And what does that mean for the presidential race as it stands? We'll talk about a couple of other important races here in the state of Wisconsin as well. Again, that's with political science professor Jerry Mast on Thursday's morning show. And on Friday, we'll be looking at one of the greatest legends in the history of country western music, George Jones. We'll be talking with the author of a brand new biography about George Jones. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for The Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad.